KPFB in Berkeley and 88.1 KFCF in Fresno.
Good morning and welcome to the Morning Mix. I am the Minister of Information, J.R., who is glad to be back with you after a two-week hiatus. First, I just want to salute all of the prisoners around California for standing against conditions in the security housing unit, as well as in California concentration camps as a whole. Many of the protesters haven't ate or drank any water in 20 days. Let's do everything we can to make sure that their demands are met and that they do not die. Today's show is on the ever-increasing police murders that have happened across the Bay Area in the last 2 years. But before we get to that, we have to check in with the news department.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Eileen Alfandari with news headlines for Wednesday, July 20th. A Senate panel is holding a historic first hearing on repealing the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, which defines marriage as between one man and one woman. California Senator Dianne Feinstein has authored the measure to repeal the law, commonly referred to as DOMA.
DOMA was wrong in 1996, and it is wrong today. 27 of my colleagues and myself have introduced the Respect for Marriage Act. Our bill is simple. It strikes DOMA from federal law.
Yesterday, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney announced that President Obama supports the legislation to repeal the Defense of Marriage Act. New York Republican Congressman Peter King said such a repeal would devalue marriage and its central role in society.
All of human experience points to one committed relationship between a man and a woman as the core building block to society. It takes a man and a woman to have children, and children are necessary for the next generation. And we need to provide to them, pass through to them, the values of our civilization and the family.
The Senate Judiciary Committee heard from 77-year-old Ron Wallen of Indio. Just 4 months ago, he lost his husband and partner of 58 years to leukemia. Wallen said because federal law denies him his husband's Social Security survivor's benefit, he's in danger of losing his home as well.
That additional benefit would have done for me what it does for every other surviving spouse in America. Ease the pain of the loss, helped during a very difficult transition, and allowed time to make decisions and plan for my future alone. Yet I could not depend on this benefit after 50 years with my spouse, simply because of DOMA. This is unfair. This is unjust.
Senator Feinstein said she's under no illusion that Congress will act this year to repeal the Defense of Marriage Act, but said the committee hearing is an important first step. The United Nations has declared a famine in two regions of drought-stricken southern Somalia. Mark Bowden is the humanitarian coordinator for Somalia.
In some parts of Somalia, malnutrition rates have reached extraordinarily high levels of 50% for children under five. More generally, the affected areas have seen 30% rates of global acute malnutrition, meaning that at least one in three children have suffered from severe food shortages, imperiling their lives.
Bowden said the UN is appealing for $300 million in aid over the next 2 months for Somalia. San Francisco police say they arrested about 35 protesters who marched through city streets to condemn the fatal weekend police shooting of a 19-year-old man. Police declared the gathering of about 150 protesters an unlawful assembly last night. A police spokesperson said those arrested would be cited for failure to disperse. TV footage showed a protester dropping a smoke bomb in a light rail train station. Kenneth Wade Harding was shot and killed in the Bayview neighborhood Saturday after he allegedly fired at two officers who had asked him if he had a muni transfer. But protesters noted Harding was shot in the back and called it a police execution. Harding was on parole after serving time in Washington State and was wanted for questioning in the shooting death of a pregnant 19-year-old Seattle woman. The Gaza Freedom Flotilla has suffered sabotage and Israeli blockade and actions by Greece to hold up the flotilla's boats in Greek ports. Flotilla supporters in San Francisco went to the Greek consulate to urge the country to release the flotilla boats and to voice their rejection of a Greek offer to send humanitarian aid to Gaza instead. Christopher Martinez reports.
Greece has offered to ship humanitarian aid to Gaza on behalf of the flotilla, but the flotilla activists have rejected that offer. Jane Jewell is a spokesperson for the United States flotilla boat, the Audacity of Hope. She was part of a delegation that delivered a letter to the Greek consulate in San Francisco.
We refuse to accept your breadcrumbs. Your offer to deliver the cargo of the Freedom Flotilla entrenches the notion that humanitarian aid will solve our problems and is a weak attempt to disguise your complicity in Israel's blockade.
Most of the Gaza Freedom Flotilla 2 boats remain blocked in Greek ports. Marios Belibasakis is vice consul in the Greek consulate in San Francisco. Belibasakis says many other countries have also blocked the Gaza flotilla, and Greece is bound by international law.
When there are some boats that they want to break a blockade, which most probably Israel has the right to have this blockade in Gaza waters, they weren't able to allow it.
Darlene Wallach of the Free Gaza Movement disagrees. She was on the first Free Gaza Movement boat that reached Gaza City in 2008. She says it's the blockade that is illegal, not the flotilla.
The blockade is collective punishment on 1.6 million Palestinians, and the blockade is a violation of international law.
Reporting from the Greek consulate in San Francisco, I'm Christopher Martinez.
British Prime Minister David Cameron told an emergency session of Parliament that in hindsight, he regretted hiring his former communications chief, Andy Coulson. Coulson's a former editor at Rupert Murdoch's now defunct News of the World tabloid. He's one of 10 people arrested in the phone hacking and police bribery scandal that has ensnared some of Britain's top police, politicians, and journalists. British Prime Minister Cameron defended the steps his government is taking to investigate the scandal.
We now have a well-led police investigation which will examine criminal behavior by the media and corruption in the police. We have set up a wide-ranging and independent judicial inquiry under Lord Justice Leveson to establish what went wrong, why, and what we need to do to ensure it never happens again.
British Prime Minister David Cameron. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area, sunny and warmer with highs in the upper 70s to mid 80s around the bay, the mid 90s in the warmest interior valleys. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny, highs 92 to 97 degrees. I'll have more news at 10 on Letters and Politics. Be sure to join us at 6 for the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Eileen Alfandary.
You are listening to The Morning Mix with the Minister of Information, J.R. Don't forget that the KPFA Summer Fun Drive is coming up August 1st through the 11th, so we need your donations to keep us on the air. The topic today on the show is police terrorism and murder in Bay Area communities. On today's show, we are scheduled to talk with paramedic Sean Gillis and his lawyer, Phil Horn, about his whistleblowing activities, which in part have to do with the case of Oscar Grant. We will also talk to Lori Davis, the mother of Raheem Brown, who was murdered by the Oakland Police Department on January 22nd of this year in front of Skyline High School. And right now we're going to talk to Willie Radcliffe, the publisher of the San Francisco Bayview newspaper, a radical and much needed progressive newspaper that is financially fighting for its own survival. Last Saturday, unarmed 19-year-old Kenneth Harding was shot 5 times on camera and allowed to die by the San Francisco Police Department after he ran from a muni station because he did not have the money to pay the fare. And what some call a recession, but what we in the black community call a depression. And I think it's very important for us to have Willie Radcliffe on because the murder was done about a block away from his house. And even police front media, even including police front media in this building, said that he fired 5 shots, which you can see on the video that can be found at blockreportradio.com and sfbayview.com. is a complete lie. It's a justification for the police to take somebody's life and not have the public ask any questions. Willie Radcliffe, are you with us?
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about last Saturday when Kenneth Harding, an unarmed 19-year-old black male, was gunned down and shot 5 times in front of the community of Hunters Point, about a block away from your house? Can you tell us what happened and what has the response been from the community?
Well, the response from the community certainly is outrage at it taking place and not right in front of the community. There's a lot of people that sits around in that area. There's an area that's beautiful on Mendel. It's a park-like, beautiful bricks and seats. So people sit there all during the day. And right across from that is the Muni platform. And so there was a whole lot of people seeing what happened and took place. I was off shopping, so I didn't get back. It probably was about 15 or 20 minutes after it had happened. And, of course, I went out there, and I stayed out there some 2 hours going around talking to people and watching what was going on. And, of course, they had the riot squads. You never seen so many automatic weapons in your life. And, of course, they wouldn't let people get to the youngster that had been shot. And it was just devastating to watch, you know, anybody that's seen it. So, and if you haven't been on the website, sfbayview.com, and looked at it, and also look at some of the videos that's on there, and, you know, it just really, you know, it just upsets you to see that kind of thing happening. You know, you don't even, you know, you don't expect to see that in Haiti and different places around the country. But right here in Bayview Hunters Point, the police department and throughout the Bay Area in the cities, we're having the same problem. And it's something we're going to really have to work on to get it changed around.
There's been Associated Press reports, and they have been echoed all over the news, even in the quote-unquote progressive press, that Kenneth Harding actually fired shots at the San Francisco police officers. Was a gun found, and do you believe shots were fired based on your interaction with the witnesses?
No. No shots. No gun. That's just a lie. And the police do that in every shooting that they're involved in. They come up with either I thought he had a gun, or he moved, or he went for a gun, went for, you know, he made a move. You know, that's what they use all the time. And now they even have a law out there that you can't say who the police are. You know, who are the police that did the shooting? They won't talk about that, just cover everything up, and everybody's supposed to believe whatever they say. But if you go back and check in all the shootings that they've done before, they come up with the same thing, you know, and they just keep killing people, especially people of color, especially African-Americans and young men. Those are our warriors that they're killing out there, and it's all about taking the land out here and moving people out and developing out here to go way higher than the police department. You know, the mayor, board of supervisors and out there. And what they do.
Wait, before we get into that, I want to just know a little bit more about the case, because some people didn't see the actual video. And I understand, because I did see the video, unarmed Kenneth Harding, 19 years old, was actually shot, and he was alive, still, where the police encircled him and held the audience off and basically allowed him to die. As I understand, it took a while for the ambulance to even get there. Am I right? Is that what you saw and what you experienced?
Well, that's it. I seen him laying in the street. I seen him laying in the street myself with my own eyes, and the police not letting anybody get to him. I was there when, you know, he must have laid there a good 25 minutes.
With you being an older black man, how does this compare to, say, I know you're from Texas, how does this compare to, say, the Klan?
Well, it actually is the same thing. It's the same as the Klan, and they kill people. You know, And, of course, the area I'm from, you know, we had our own little army. They didn't come in our neighborhood. You know, the only white came in our neighborhood was the mailman that went through our neighborhood. And, you know, we were ready in case they started anything. Because the sheriff told everybody don't go down there because they're crazy.
Can you
right.
speak?
So, you know, and but we had owned our own land. We had a way to make our own living. So we didn't have to worry about we needed them for anything. So that's the difference of where I came from is, you know, we raised everything for ourselves.
Well, last question. Let me cut in a little bit because we're running out of time. Can you speak to how the police terrorism is also intertwined with economics in the community and the recent battle that you guys were facing, or that we as a newspaper were facing, because I'm the associate editor also. But can you talk a little bit about that battle and how that economic battle is entwined with the battle against the police?
That's where it all started, with economics. Is you know, other words, like when they build a light rail out here, you know, it was all about pushing people out, repeopling. That was the primary purpose of the redevelopment agents, to repeople areas and bring in yuppies and push out the people that's there. And the developers and the banks and the insurance companies, they don't, and real estate brokers, they make the money and the people get pushed out. And then we have a mentality here of care not cash. Other words, keep a permanent underclass going. And then, of course, when you hit a depression, the next group of people up, they fall down. So they join the permanent underclass. So that's the mentality we have here. I even talked to a black guy the other day, and he said, you know, I voted for care not cash. I said, oh, yeah, you just about down there. Where you voted for? You know, so that's the mentality that we have in San Francisco. The police department is being told by the people downtown, hey, you keep the boot on those people because we want them out of there. And that's the economics part of it. If we don't get the economics going, the discrimination against jobs, business opportunities, loans, and for our people, if we don't step up to the plate and demand, it's going to keep on happening. It's going to keep happening.
If people would like to help the San Francisco Bayview, the much-needed San Francisco Bayview financially, because we understand that the newspaper is in dire straits, or if they would like to see more information on this case or other cases of police terrorism or government abuse, where do they go and how do they get in touch with you?
Well, the phone number is 415-671-0789. Our email address is publisher@sfbayview.com. And, of course, our website is sfbayview.com. And we put all our stories and stuff on it. We put stories on there daily. And we also have a nonprofit that people that want to donate, rather than to give the money to the government who got wars, not only wars going on all over the world, but got wars going on right here in our community, you know, so you can get a write-off. And the Bayview is something we need. I'm not saying it because I own it, but it's part of my heart to help people. I feel good when people are doing well. And, you know, so I'm going to keep going. But people out there that want to help, what would we have if we didn't have the Bayview out there? The Bayview print stories, no other one will print. All we want to find out if there's some truth in it and if it's something that the people need to know, not the Rufus Murdoch type of news that's going on out there.
Thank you, Willie Radcliffe, publisher of the San Francisco Bayview newspaper.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, all Malcolm X man. Yeah, dead the president. Fred Armstrong man. Revolution man. All type soldier. See. All rude boy, all type. Yeah. Cop shot, cop shot, cop shot, cop shot. Keep shooting my people, we will shoot back. Me bring the M1, you bust your clock. Rap a pump, pump, pump. Oh, you like that? 187 pun undercover cop. Another dead pig, now stay off my block. Cop shot,
pass me. This is for my niggas in the streets getting frizzed. Gun to your head, handcuffs on your wrist. Everywhere we at, we got the star to resist. Black poor people get no justice. The court, the judge, and the jury is fixed. Every ghetto we go through, sick of this shit. Throw up your fist if you sick of this shit. The only good cop is a dead cop. Police brutality must come to a stop. Them kill Latino, then kill more blacks. Louima in Brooklyn, the Gallo and the Bronx. We spark rebellion, watch them get rumped. Self-defense is not a violent act. Police murder, one up as a back. Giuliani, send them troops to attack. Them soon retreat, watch them run back. Cop shot, cop shot, cop shot. Cop shot, cop shot, cop shot.
This is the Minister of Information, JR, and you are listening to The Morning Mix. Today's show is dedicated to police terrorism. We just talked with Willie Radcliffe, the publisher of the San Francisco Bayview newspaper, about the recent San Francisco shooting, which happened last Saturday, of unarmed Kenneth Harding. Now we're going to bring Sean Gillis, a whistleblowing paramedic from the Oakland Fire Department, and his lawyer, Phil Horn, into the studio. And we're going to talk about some disturbing slash criminal activities of the Oakland Fire Department in collusion with the Oakland Police Department. Greetings, Sean and Phil.
Morning, JR.
First, Sean, let's talk a little bit about the Oscar Grant case. Many people on this station are very well versed on what happened on the platform of the Fruitvale BART station on January 1st, 2009. You were an investigator for the Oakland Fire Department. Can you tell us a little bit about your take on what happened and what it is that you were investigating for the Oakland Fire Department?
Sure. Well, on January 6th, I basically attempted to launch an investigation into what happened. And initially, that was well received, and I was met with approval. And then it was I was directed to not do an investigation, to redirect that to the medical director, who was Dr. Howard Michaels at the time, to never speak of it, to not contact the paramedic who was on the call, to basically, you know, bury it deep down in the, you know, you will never think of, you will never talk of box. And from that point on, the investigation was, from what I understand, interfered with further. It never happened. And then there was a whole other sequence of events that followed that are kind of unbelievable.
I know you were investigating the murder, but what were your findings in this investigation, and what was the Oakland Fire Department scared of? We're going to point this to your lawyer, Phil Horn. What was the Oakland Fire Department scared of when Sean Gillis came back with his investigation?
Well, the patient care report indicated that the paramedic had only treated the entry wound. Oscar Grant was shot in the back while he was pressed against the cement. So it made the bullet made both an exit and an entry wound, and only the entry wound was treated. The exit wound was not treated with a penetrating chest injury. You have to treat with an airtight bandage, or the chest cavity loses pressure and a person cannot absorb oxygen through their lungs. So the Oakland Fire Department was concerned that it might be that the paramedic's misconduct resulted in or contributed to the death of Oscar Grant. So as soon as word permeated to the upper levels, Sean was ordered to stop his investigation. And for anybody who has questions about whether this actually happened or not, you know, all of these orders and requests were in writing, and they're attached to our complaint, which is available at IndieBay and other places on the web. They're in writing, they're emails.
I understand that there was actual fallout when Sean protested not being able to be a part of this. I understand that there were other employees involved. Can you speak a little bit about the sequence of events and how it came to you and your client coming to KPFA and sitting on this show?
Well, what happened was Sean and the medical director, who's the highest ranking medical authority in the fire department, engaged in an inner battle in OFD for an investigation. The medical director ordered a call review, which is where you bring the paramedic in and you ask them questions about the treatment or mistreatment of the patient. The medical director's paychecks were interfered with by the EMS division manager at that point, at the point when he requested a call review. And he and Sean engaged in an 18-month battle for Dr. Michael's paychecks and for the investigation to proceed. Dr. Michael's left in September of 2010, owed 6 months of pay. And at that point, the retaliation turned to Sean. He was immediately, on October 4th, asked to sign a letter of resignation that he didn't write, and he was not allowed to read it. And when he didn't do that, they reprimanded him. They demoted him. They suspended him. And they were conducting one investigation after another to lead to a termination.
I understand that your complaint doesn't just deal with the case of Oscar Grant, but there are 42 pages that deal with many things. Am I right?
Yeah, that's correct. There's racism that permeates just about every aspect of the fire department. You know, the current interim chief Hoffman, was interviewed by PBS in 2000 about integration of the fire department because it was not integrated in the beginning of the 21st century. And he indicated that discrimination should be understood as having contributed to having big, strong firefighters because they
Wow.
came from the right families. And this is actually in black and white. You can read it on the PBS website. You can watch it in the Test of Courage documentary. So it's kind of amazing that nothing happened to Interim Chief Hoffman after he made those statements. Actually, he got promoted. As Sean's telling me, he got promoted after he made those statements. And he also indicated that he favored hazing and that he resisted getting rid of hazing, even though hazing was shown to force women and people of color to leave. So basically, you have a situation now where recruitment occurs only through CPR training classes that are known to be where white men can be recruited. There's no recruiting in the African American or Latino or LGBT or women areas. And then in hiring, promotion, every single aspect of the fire department, there's discrimination. And there's discrimination in that they refuse to comply with Measure Y. Even though they get $4 million in Measure Y tax money a year, they refuse to implement the at-risk youth mentoring program that they're required to do. And at the same time, they have moved to restrict Merritt College from having access to OFD's equipment in favor of a for-profit white school called NCTI.
Let's bring it back to Sean. Sean, you just heard a little bit about Willie Radcliffe talking about the case of Kenneth Harding. I know you've heard about the recent BART shooting of the white guy not too long ago. We have Lori Davis coming up with the Oakland Police Department shooting that happened outside of a high school in Oakland. I mean, how do you look at police terrorism where at one time you were part of the establishment, and I mean, I guess you still are part of the establishment, but you're also a whistleblower in the establishment. So how do you look at these cases that come up?
Well, first of all, I'm white. So, and I'm also, even though I have been poor in the past, I make enough money to live in a relatively safe neighborhood in Oakland and all those sort of things. So my experiences are not representative of everybody. And one of the things that is interesting, having taught for Merritt College, having taught their EMT program and once been the program director, and having taught community CPR programs, and coming into contact with a lot of youth of today from a variety of backgrounds, I'm kind of disturbed by the how wide-ranged the perception is of that people are persecuted by the police, and that is having that not been my experience seems really unfortunate, because how can that bridge be built, or how can people feel safe, especially in some of the most dangerous neighborhoods where you'd think that sort of service or protection would be needed? I know that sounds like kind of an academic answer, but it seems to me, like if one person, like what's that Bob Marley saying? Fool some people some of the time, you can't fool all the people all the time. Well, same thing is, it's used in online surveys and stuff like that. I believe it's called poll surveying. So if you talk to, 50 different people and they all say the same thing, unless they've all been getting their information from the same place, it's probably true, right? So, it's concerning.
Last question. What can you say about the culture of the fire department when these type of police shootings, police killings, police terrorism happens? I mean, what is the general sentiment of the fire department? Is most firemen on the side of the Oakland Police Department, who you guys, I'm sure, network with, play sports games with and stuff like that? Or is it on the side of the people?
Yeah. Well, one thing I think is difficult for anybody to wrap their minds around, especially looking at people in blue uniforms with badges on, is that it's just a big group of people, right? Like any other group of people. And people can be, the larger group can be socialized to think one thing or another through their work or training or whatever. But there's always going to be more than one dialogue. So my impression is that people get into the career profession of being paramedics and firefighters out of goodwill. They usually want to help people and be a part of a really positive process. But it is something that has this case especially has exposed a huge internal dialogue, which is basically, from my perception, split the department into two departments. One department that is, quietly supportive of me. When nobody's around, they'll say, keep your head up, that sort of thing. And the other department, which won't look at me, won't shake my hand, that won't talk to me, that sort of thing, or says stuff behind my back. And the interesting thing about that, which I didn't expect to see, is that there's a color line in that. There appears to be a color line in that as well, which I actually didn't expect, which made a big impression on me.
What's next for your particular case? And what are you and your lawyer, Phil Horn, what are you guys pushing to do? And how can the listeners help?
I was listening to a song last night, and the very end of the song ironically is called Waking Up. And the very end of the song, you say over and over again, I'll walk until my feet are bleeding. And I think that kind of resonates with our case, because it feels certainly like kind of a death march where it never ends. But I'm sure that's not a common experience to a lot of activists.
Thank you, Sean Gillis. Thank you, Phil Horn, for being with us. Please stay with us, because we're going to open up the phone lines after our next guest, Lori Davis. And we would love to have you guys with us.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you.
Until the philosophy which owed one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Longer, first best or second.
You are listening to The Morning Mix with the Minister of Information, J.R. Now, our next guest is Lori Davis. She is the mother of 22-year-old unarmed Raheem Brown, who was murdered by the Oakland Police Department on January 22nd near Skyline High School in the Oakland Hills. How are you today, Lori?
I'm hanging in here.
For the people who don't know the story of Raheem Brown, can you take us back to that day and what actually happened to your son?
Well, on January 22nd, about 9:15 p.m., the Oakland Unified School Police executed my son. Their claim was a screwdriver why they killed him.
A screwdriver? A screwdriver is something that you could buy at Ace Hardware. That is not illegal. So what actually happened, and what actually happened versus what did they say happened?
What actually happened is that him and his female friend were parked near the park, eating some food. And the police officers came up and started to beat on them because my son was telling them, he was like, what are you messing with me for? Why are you bothering us? And apparently, from what I was told from the witness, is that they started beating on him and her. They tried to drag him out the car window. And, sorry. This is so hard.
It's okay.
And one officer was on bat, apparently was on her side, or Beluso. I'm not really too clear on that yet. And Beluso was on the other side, and the officer on her side shot over her and shot him several times, one in the face, the cheek, the heart, the arms, the chest. So it's real traumatic.
Now, they shot your son a number of times, and I know that you have pictures. Was your son armed with any guns, and did they find any weapons inside of his car?
It wasn't his car. He was just a passenger of this vehicle. They said that they found a gun somewhere in the back somewhere, so I have no idea. We're still working those details out.
Right, something very similar to what they say to Kenneth Harding.
Right.
I know that you've been involved in a lot of, like, protesting, and I know that you're fighting on a campaign that we definitely endorse to get the police out of the Oakland School District.
Correct.
Can you speak a little bit about the campaign? Because I also understand that the officers that were involved in the shooting of your son, they work in the Oakland schools.
Yes, they do.
What is their names and where do they work?
Sergeant Jonathan Beluso, he's the watch commander for the Oakland Unified School District Police. And Sergeant Burham Batt. You know, I know that he used to be a park ranger.
And tell us a little bit about your campaign. I know that you and Shango and Tim and Jabari and a number of other people, Taisha and them that support you, have been going to the school district. Why?
Because we want to get these officers out of the schools. There's no reason for police to be in schools with guns. The only thing they need is regular security. They are they get funding of $5 million a year.
Wow.
Yes. And they've cut out counseling. They've cut out, what was it? It was the counseling. They laid off all these teachers, you know, and the children are suffering.
Hey, and I just also want to bring out to the KPFA listeners, many of you guys know the name Dan Siegel. Dan Siegel was very involved in bringing the police into the Oakland schools. He's associated with this radio station. So I just wanted to make sure that the KPFA listeners know that Dan Siegel was involved with bringing the Oakland police into the Oakland schools in the year 2000. And how do I know that? Because I helped to protest it. But if people would like to get with your organizing, what is the next date? What is the campaign for Raheem Brown? What's happening next?
Well, we're getting ready to protest on August 10th. And we're going to meet at the Lake Mary BART station at 3:30 p.m. We're going to have a rally. And then we're going to go to the school board. And we have certain demands, but we're not publicizing all the demands over the radio.
No doubt. So August 10th, where?
August 10th at the Lake Mary BART station at 3:30 p.m.
Okay. Well, Thanks again, Lori. Well, before you wait, go ahead.
I wanted to also say something else. If anyone wants to look up on Jonathan Beluso, they can go to the sanfranciscogate.com, and they have to look up the article of March 22nd, 2001. And it says some of the statements on how Beluso's police brutality has affected people's lives, even before this.
Wow. I definitely urge everybody to go. And Lori, I want you to stay with us because we're about to open up the phone lines. And we have Sean Gillis, Phil Horn, and hopefully Lori Davis to be able to help us field some of the questions.
Okay.
Is that okay with you?
That's okay.
And last but not least, where do people get more information on Raheem Brown? I know you guys have a Facebook. I know you guys have web groups or something like
that. Yes, we have Justice for Raheem Brown on Facebook. And then we also have an email, Justice for Raheem Brown Jr. at Gmail.
Well, thanks again, Lori. Stay strong. And you know that the Morning Mix, the Block Report, the San Francisco Bayview, we're all behind you.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a music break. After we come from the music break, you can call in. The phone number is 510-848-4425 so that we can have this spirited discussion on police terrorism and police murder in Bay Area communities.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war, and poverty. Oh, wake up, all the teachers, come to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. But just let it be. Na, 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me.
Again, we're about to open up the phone lines. The phone number is 510-848-4425 if you would like to call in and weigh in on this discussion on police terrorism. First caller is Daniel from Oakland. How are you?
I'm okay, JR, and thank you for this opportunity. And the first thing I would like to say is I want to extend my very sincere condolences to your guest, and to the friends and families of so many people. I mean, it's just too much to even. This is an organized campaign of terrorism, and while it is at the present time directed largely towards the Black community, and perhaps to a lesser degree, well, I'm not sure that, you know, other people of color. This police terrorism is part of, I have spoken many, many times, I've been a member for over 30 years, and I've spoken many, many times about the fact that we are living in a fascist police state in consolidation. It's nearly completely consolidated now. This is organized terror. It is designed specifically to paralyze the public into a state of complete submission. And we must organize all of us. I actually am willing to have meetings at my home to discuss how we can approach this. And again, I can only say that my heart bleeds Too much is too much. It's not enough is enough. This is way too much. It never should have happened. We should never let it go.
Right on. Thank you, Daniel. Next, we have Kaniba from Berkeley. Are you there, caller?
Please, good morning. Is this me?
Yes, it is.
I'm calling because I would like to address the spiritual aspect of the what you've been discussing this morning, and that we put prayer and divine love and light and healing energy around the families involved, the people involved, and the community. Because we really need to address that people's hearts and souls need to be healed. And that we
let me ask you this.
Can't come to a gathering.
Well, caller.
Actually at noon.
Caller.
Yes.
Let me ask you this. You know, I hear a lot of people say this stuff about healing. But how the hell can we heal when the police is still killing people in the streets?
You know what? We focus on what we want, brother. Not on what we don't want.
I mean, people wanted it into slavery.
Need to make a shift in consciousness. The community needs to activate their spiritual power. They are not doing that. We have to understand we have backup from our ancestors.
Right on. Thank you, caller.
Nat Turner.
Thank you. Thank you, Kaniba. Next, we're talking to Charles. We're asking all our callers to be very concise so that we can get as many callers as possible on the line. We still have Sean Gillis, Phil Horn, and Lori Davis in the studio if you would like to talk directly to them. The phone number is 510-848-4425 if you would like to join the discussion. Next caller is Charles in Vallejo.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good, Charles.
My condolences to all the families involved, but I mean, there's nothing you can say, but to be precise, I'm a member of KPFA, so is my brother. My brother's been a police officer for 40 years. He's never shot anybody. He's never had complaints against him for brutalizing anybody. And I really ask that we can caution about condemning a whole group of people. It's like, it's just as bad as cops saying that all blacks are hoodlums or whatever. It's just as bad to say that all cops are pigs or all cops are crazy or all cops are trying to brutalize the community.
All right, well, let me ask you a question, Charles. Let me ask you a question. I think that people feel that way, and me specifically, I feel that way because the police department, whether you talk about it's a good cop or a bad cop, they cover for each other. There's a no snitch clause that Phil Horn can speak on, because I heard him say it in an earlier interview, between the fire department and the Oakland Police Department, and they don't tell on each other whether they're a good cop or a bad cop. Now, what I would ask you about your brother, has your brother ever turned in any cops? Because I'm sure he's seen some that have unjustifiably beat up somebody or killed somebody if he hasn't done it. Has he done that?
He has never said to me that he's unjustifiably beat up anyone or seen any of his partners do that. And because he has spoken up, he has been somewhat ostracized by the rest of the cops. You know, when he's just complained about small things, about racial epithets or about, you know, just profiling jokes. And so it happens, and just like the fireman that you had on before, you know, and it's like the community at large. You can come out and you can be a whistleblower, and then the next thing you know, you're nothing. You're nobody. You don't have a job. You can't feed yourself. So we have to take all that into consideration. I understand what you're saying, but, you know, we're just human. I mean, my brother's just a human being just like I am. You know, and
I agree. We're not so much attacking your brother as much as we're attacking that the police are an occupying army in our community. But that's just my opinion. Thank you, Charles, for calling. I want to get Sean Gillis to weigh in. Do you have anything to say about that, Sean Gillis?
It's a complicated subject. When I have a lot of internal dialogues about this with people I'm close to, and somebody I respect a great deal said, and I try not to bring into names because I don't want to bring anybody into this conversation who doesn't want to be in this conversation, but he's a well-respected individual, African-American, says, you know, the police have been beating people up since the Romans. And I thought that was an interesting comment because that's probably true. Having said that, you know, I personally am close to some police officers as friends. I know a police officer who's a breast cancer survivor and tries to help, really look for opportunities to reach out and help mothers and children and that sort of thing. Having said that, there's one of the things that is, if it's not an EMT book, it's certainly, taught is that, in EMT classes and that sort of thing is, you cops are the only people who have your back out there. So, you've got to really form a strong, relationship with them. And, I am aware of instances, again, not using name of, like, this was years and years ago, of a paramedic friend of mine who does not work at the Oakland Fire Department, who witnessed a young woman have her arm broken by the police while crossing the street for apparently no reason. And he didn't feel like he could do anything because he felt at the end of the day that what he expressed to me, rather, was that at the end of the day, there wouldn't be anybody to have his back if he... reported what he saw. So, people are motivated by different things, and sometimes it's fear.
Thank you. That was the voice of Phil Horn, a paramedic whistleblower. Next, we'll go to Joe in San Francisco.
Hello.
Okay. Hello. 30 seconds, Joe.
Yeah, just calling to say that this is something that San Francisco has been experiencing for a while now, but I've been noticing that the nation's experiencing it as well. And this is just one indication that we have the police on a nationwide level being militarized, and this is a they're the foot soldiers of fascism, corporate fascism that has been handed down to us. So that type of dynamic really does kill morale over time in an individual and a group, and that's what's happening. That's why you have these protocols where the police can't actually be whistleblowers on the people, the bad cops. The good cops can't be whistleblowers on the bad cops. They are sticking together.
It's a game.
And they have had that mental programming to do so. And the woman that talked about the spiritual growth, that is something that the communities across America actually really have to do. And they're going to have to confront the police on that, not in a violent way, but in a spiritual way that is going to be able to be heard.
All right. Well, let me just stop you there, man, because I don't like my shows to be about a lot of cliche and you talk about nonviolence and all that. We tried that.
Well, you can try violence, but you will lose.
Let me say this because I listen to you. There have been organized bodies who have violently defended their community, whether they're known as the Deacons of Defense, whether they're known as the Black Liberation Army, whether they're known as elements of the early Black guerrilla family that didn't allow these type of things to happen to the Black community. Now, I'm not married to violence or nonviolence. I'm married to the objective of survival. You know, by whatever means we have to do to survive, to me, that's what we should be doing. The first law in nature is self-preservation. You know, everything wants to stay alive. So why is it that Black people, specifically people of color and victims of police terrorism, shouldn't enact that law of nature?
I understand and I agree with you, but I think that they are planning on whatever race it is that is being attacked doesn't really matter. That the fascism.
But it does, though, when it's undoubtedly us. So we're not talking about abstractly. We're talking about a Black community.
I understand. I'm talking about nationally and globally the fact that there is there have been orders handed down by the powers that be that said become more aggressive.
That's but I'm saying happened. They're killing us regardless. So I'm saying and whether they kill – wait, hold on. Listen. Whether they kill us and we fight back or they kill us and we stand here, I mean, you tell me what makes more sense to you.
I'm just saying that you're going to have to find another dynamic because they're pushing you to actually become more violent so they can do the same thing.
Well, they're genocidally killing us anyway, but thank you, caller. Last caller, we're going to have Mubarak from Oakland.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call, and good morning. It is a systemic racism throughout the United States. I grew up in East Palo Alto, you know, and what happens when cops kill blacks is just like the lady was saying about the guy Beluso, who's the Oakland officer who killed her son. All they do is transfer to other cities and other departments. They are not held accountable. You know, I like the remedy that Lavelle Mixon had. He took four of them with him. And then I feel like we're not going to be respected until we do like suicide bombers in Iran and Iraq and throughout the Middle East who are willing to die as long as you take some of them with us. You know, we're not going to be respected. All other races come here on our back, on our shoulders of civil rights movements and marchings and sit-ins, and all of them have excelled to have stores, beauty shops, anything they need. The only people without a community is the black people. And I don't see how black people can call in and say our community. We don't have a community. Our community, everybody lives in it. Arabs, Latinos, and then they own and run all the stores.
Right. We're running out of time, man. But thank you. Thank you, caller. Thank you, Mubarak, for calling in. We just got to the time, so I want to thank our guests, Phil Horn, Sean Gillis, Lori Davis, and also Willie Ratcliffe for being with us. I also want to thank Kirsten Thomas and Anthony Fest for playing their part behind the scenes. I'm the Minister of Information, JR. But before we get out of here, on August 12th and August 13th, there will be the Ankh Marketing 7-year anniversary, which will feature Erykah Badu on the Wheels of Steel August 12th and Questlove from the Roots on the Wheels of Steel August 13th. Erykah Badu at the mezzanine, Questlove at the Public Works. If you would like to win tickets, be callers 9 and 10. The phone number is 510-848-4425. And until next week, I am the Minister of Information, JR, signing off for the Morning Mix. Look out for Andres and Anita tomorrow. We out.
Fabulous, outrageous star of nearly 40 films is going to be in Berkeley on August the 17th. This is Chris Welch, and I get to talk with Jane on stage about her phenomenally dramatic life. I mean, just consider some of the men. Henry and Roger Vadim, Tom Hayden, Ted Turner. And then there's Jane's powerful feminism. She co-founded the Women's Center in Gloria Steinem, her controversial opposition to the Vietnam War, her ongoing work with Eve Ensler, her Academy Awards, Golden Globes, not to mention her best-selling works on health and fitness. Plus, we'll discuss her big brand new book, Prime Time, and oh, just be there. August 17th, 7:30 p.m., First Congregational Church, 2345 Channing in Berkeley. It's a KPFA benefit. There's wheelchair access. Tickets are only $15 at brownpapertickets.com or our lovely local bookstores. Check kpfa.org for full information.